The new book, Integration Nation, takes readers on a cross-country journey, introducing us to the people challenging America's xenophobic impulses by welcoming immigrants and collaborating with the foreign-born as they become integral members of their new communities. In recent years, politicians in a handful of local communities and states have passed laws and regulations designed to make it easier to deport unauthorized immigrants or to make their lives so unpleasant that they just leave. But in Integration Nation, we visit places like in Utah, where we meet educators who connect newly arrived Spanish-speaking students and U.S.-born English-speaking students who share classrooms and learn in two languages. In North Carolina, we visit the nation's fastest-growing community development credit union, serving immigrants and U.S.-born depositors and helping to lower borrowing thresholds and crime rates alike. Susan Eaton is the professor of the practice and director of the Sillerman Center for the Advancement of Philanthropy at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management. The name of the new book is Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at Its Best. And we welcome Susan Eaton to the roundtable this morning. Susan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's great to be here.
What brought you to look at this journey to places where people are welcoming immigrants?
In 2010, as you know, many of us know, Arizona's legislature, signed into law by their governor, Jan Brewer, passed a notoriously restrictive law that encouraged racial profiling and also restricted immigrants' movements and was designed to really either get immigrants to leave the state or to make it easier to deport them. And I saw the media focusing this unrelenting attention on this law, which was an important thing to understand and to fight against. And I saw many people who I worked with, civil rights activists, other people at nonprofits fighting against this law and decrying it. But what I knew was happening across the country because of previous research in this area was that there was another side to the story with regard to immigration in America, and that immigration was really playing out at the local level in communities and in different spaces that were unlikely places that you wouldn't necessarily think of, where people were working to welcome immigrants, put programs in place to support immigrants, working alongside and collaborating with immigrants so that they could find prosperity and well-being in a way that benefited not just the immigrant community, but the community as a whole.
And it seems as though all of this goes on under a discussion along with a debate politically over our immigration system in this country.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the media attention and the discussion, even at dinner tables, is and our immigration policy at the federal level is really focused on the two questions, and this is an oversimplification, but basically the questions are who gets to stay in the country and who has to go, who belongs in America and who doesn't, right? But that's not really the question that is driving ordinary life in communities, where you see immigrants coming in, people starting to get used to the difference and the diversity in their community over time, mayors, aldermen, librarians, teachers, understanding that immigrants are indeed a part of their communities. And in order for the full community to succeed and be prosperous and be a place where people want to move to, where businesses want to, you know, set up shop, that's safe, that immigrants need to be welcomed and become full and equal members and feel a sense of belonging in their communities.
So, again, at the risk of oversimplification, it's an awful lot like how we think of our congressional representatives, where we like the person who is representing us, but we don't like Congress as a whole.
That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, but I think that I do believe that once people, a lot of the initiatives that play out on the local level, I know there's a whole range of different initiatives and programs and policies that I wrote about, but a lot of them focus on breaking down the barriers between people, correcting misunderstandings between people who are immigrants from different cultures than maybe some of the people who were born in the United States. that kind of thing. And what I believe can happen is that once people begin to think differently, they begin to act differently. And there's plenty of evidence of that, you know, in the stories that I wrote about. People began to understand immigrants are my neighbors, immigrants are my teachers, immigrants, you know, help my mother who's ill, immigrants are teaching my kids. It's a whole range of realizations that people start to come to, and then they do start to act and want to get involved and engaged in building, not just fighting against things that are racist or restrictive, but actually trying to think together about what they want a community to look like.
So when you look at the architects of this movement, how is it different from the previous efforts at integrating immigrants into our culture and society?
Well, interestingly, I mean, historically, you know, there used to be these kinds of big institutions that acted as kind of forces for integration. I mean, big labor unions, big manufacturing centers where immigrants would come in and they would get jobs. Political machines used to fight for loyalty, immigrant loyalty. But those things don't really exist and aren't really as strong in our country as they used to be. And so there's a kind of gap, there's a kind of hole missing. And that's why, you know, there's a really strong argument for having governments pay attention to the task of ensuring that immigrants can find a foothold here in their communities and that they're supported and find prosperity. But in previous years, as a sort of a notion that dominated discussion and programming around immigration that was focused on what we call assimilation. And assimilation suggests that immigrants come into our country and they begin to shed all of the things that made them distinct from the dominant culture, the prevailing culture in the United States, whether that was language or the way that they dressed or their cultural traditions, their worship traditions, or they tried to hide those things. Integration is different in that it doesn't necessarily implicitly value the dominant culture of a receiving community or of the nation, but it says, come, join, and be who you are, and bring us to the things that make you distinct from, you know, the mainstream or prevailing culture in the United States. And what's interesting is that when I say prevailing culture, I'm very self-conscious about using that term because that's changing, and a large reason for why it's changing in the United States and it means so many different things is because of immigration. So we, you know, the United States, the people who are already here in the United States will influence immigrants and their generation, second and third generation immigrants, certainly. But if you accept the idea of integration, you also leave yourself open to being influenced by immigrants, learning things, being open, learning about new traditions, whether it's food, and also understanding that immigrants aren't just people here who necessarily need help, but they bring a lot of assets to the country and to their communities.
Susan Eaton is the author of the new book, Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at Its Best. You just spoke to this about the importance of government leaders embracing local initiatives and how important that is. Give us an idea of the support that immigrants typically need during the first years when they come to the United States.
Well, I've never met, you know, there's a lot of, you know, people are always out there saying immigrants need to speak English if they're going to live here. And I have never met one immigrant in all my travels that who did not want to learn English. I may have found people who found it very difficult to either find the time to learn English or the classes to find English. And so I think that that's, first of all, really important. And I think that that should be almost like a universal no-brainer that should happen. What a lot of studies have found is that immigrants tend to come to the country with many immigrants tend to come to the country with an entrepreneurial spirit, have much more of a kind of entrepreneurial spirit than many native-born people. And so support for helping immigrants open a business, making sure that they get fair and affordable loans so that they can start businesses. And this is something that is you know, something that benefits not just immigrants but everybody, in the sense that, you know, viable local businesses play, and a lot of times in places where the population has been declining, we see a lot of evidence of this across the United States, of immigrants moving into communities that had been left behind or people were moving out of. And slowly but surely, businesses begin to pop up, and there's a kind of vitality that's restored to the places. Immigrants need to be sure that they will, you know, there's a safe place for them to put their money, to have banks and financial institutions that treat them fairly and that don't shut them out, so that they can begin to invest and begin to save money, and that they can understand that, you know, there are forces out there, predatory forces out there that will exploit them. And social integration is really important, too, preventing loneliness, especially among immigrants who are older, for example, and may not have those connections that, say, a public school or a workplace might bring to younger generations. There's a whole host of things that, you know, not people who are just immigrants, but all of us need. I mean, some of the most interesting, I feel, initiatives that I wrote about were people who simply created public spaces where people who were immigrants and people who were born in the United States could come together and could meet one another and talk to each other and get to know one another. And this happens on a multi-generational level. And it sounds really simple, and like, do I really, you know, want to go to Hazleton, Pennsylvania and write about people opening a community center? That sounds like not a great flashy story.
Right.
But on the other hand, the ripple effects of something like this are actually quite huge, because then the community center becomes a place where there are retired people who are teaching English. And then not only do you have that happening, but then you've got people who are taking Spanish classes from people who are immigrants. And so it becomes a kind of evolution of a new kind of place. And in places where there's been a kind of rift or division because of a law or because of xenophobia or whatever it might be, these kinds of spaces become really important and have all kinds of ripple effects that are very, very difficult to measure.
So you mentioned Hazleton, Pennsylvania, so let us go there for a moment and talk to us about Major League Baseball's Joe Maddon and his efforts to restore the trust between immigrant and non-immigrant populations of his hometown after a murder that occurred in 2006 of a white resident in Hazleton.
Yeah, so there had been a murder of a white resident in Hazleton, and a Latino immigrant had been charged with the crime, and the charges were later dropped. And then after that, but this caused a lot of debate and discussion and anger, and a lot of heat for it went to the Latino community. So Hazleton then, in later years, adopted a similar type of ordinance to the Arizona legislation that would have imposed fines on landlords who rented to immigrants, would have made it a crime to shelter or harbor or even give a ride to an immigrant, and then also punished employers for hiring immigrants as well. And that ordinance was later, like many of these municipal ordinances across the country, was eviscerated by the courts or just became difficult to enforce or became so expensive to fight that it was kind of a self-defeating measure. But regardless of whether the regulations passed or not, it caused a huge divide and rift within the community. Now, Joe Maddon had grown up in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, which is one of these old, kind of down on its heels, former coal towns in Pennsylvania. And when he came back for Christmas one year, he had asked his sister, who worked in social services and education in the town, hey, you know, where could I meet some Latinos? Because he had been very interested and had an affinity for Latino culture through his work, having Latino members of the baseball teams where he had been a coach or manager. He spoke Spanish himself, and his sister said, well, terrible things have happened because, you know, a lot of times a lot of Latino families are just scared to leave their houses because they're afraid that they're going to be deported. And then as Joe went around and started talking to some, you know, people he knew in town, he found that people were really blaming Latino residents for the economic decline of Hazleton, the city of Hazleton, which of course was declining economically for a wide variety, a tangled mix of social forces that were huge. And, you know, it wasn't the fault of Latino residents who had really been lured there by companies for low-paying jobs. So he wanted to do something, but in his wisdom, he said, you know, I don't want to stand up and declare what should be done, but I will donate some money, and I will use whatever celebrity status I have to try and move efforts towards integration forward. And they did numerous things through something that they called the Hazleton Integration Project. And one of the things that they did do was buy a former Catholic school and turn it into a community center that didn't just open it up, you know, for basketball or for, you know, bingo games, but deliberately was a place where the Latino community and the white community could come together for, first of all, for kids, for recreation, for a homework help center, and also where education services, you could find education services and social services. And it became a real community center, a hub that was there for everybody in the community. And it's been a big success. I mean, not everybody goes, but it's certainly a really important start. And at least they did something in reaction to the rift that had been created.
Susan Eaton is our guest. The name of the book, Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at its Best. Let's go to Lewiston, Maine now. And the reason I ask about that is because I find it fascinating in your description of how these immigrant communities typically form in this country. And Lewiston is interesting because it is the home to some 4,000 or 5,000 Somalians that came to Lewiston. So how does that happen?
How the migration of Somalis to Lewiston?
Yes.
How did it happen? Well, this is a very interesting case, and I'm not sure it's, you know, terribly, it's one of the largest, what they call secondary migrations, perhaps the largest in recent memory in the entire country. So refugees began being settled in the United States after spending many, many years in Kenyan refugee camps after fleeing the civil war in Somalia. And so what happened was the United States, they decided on a certain number of Somalis that could be settled and settled them in a wide variety of places across the country, some in Portland, Maine, some in Atlanta, some in Seattle, some in Pennsylvania, a large number in Texas, lots of different places. They settled some in Somali refugees, I'm sorry, in Portland, Maine, which was kind of down the highway south of Lewiston, which is an inland, you know, former kind of mill town that had declined in population, was very poor, and almost 100% white. Portland ran out of affordable housing, contacted folks in Lewiston. Lewiston folks had previously had some success with settling refugees from Togo in Africa, and they said, "Yes, we'll take some refugees and we'll settle them here." And so, what began as a very small settlement of refugees in available affordable housing in Lewiston quickly grew into thousands of Somalis going to Lewiston, Maine. And the way that this happened was simply through word of mouth and community. People got to Lewiston, they discovered that it was a really safe and very peaceful place. It was very quiet. They could afford the housing there. There was a lot of vacant affordable housing, and it was a place where they felt especially that their children were safe. They also felt that the schools were accessible, and this is borne out by research that's been done by other researchers about why Lewiston. They felt that the schools were very accessible, that they could go in and they could walk their kids to the schools. Where in other examples, the Somali refugees were being settled in very large housing projects in urban areas, and they felt like these places were not safe. They weren't peaceful. And so word got out that Lewiston was a good place to go, that there was space there, and buses started arriving in this, you know, again, kind of down on its heels, little scruffy former mill town where the mills had closed. And initially it caused enormous resentment among some of the city leaders who were very vocal about it. But it also, there were also a large share of people who rushed to welcome the new members of the community. And over time, it hasn't always been an easy road, but over time, refugees began to settle, began to open their own businesses. Students started finding success in the public schools, though not without many challenges. And educators there slowly started to understand that the best way to help the students from Somali backgrounds find success was to encourage them to hang on to their native language, to stay close to their parents, and to stay close to their worship, their Muslim faith, all of those things. And that was a realization that I think also took some time, but the more enlightened educators there have really come to understand that. And what's one of the things that's really interesting about Maine is the population is declining in Maine, the white population. So nearly all the growth in a state like Maine is due to immigrants and refugees. Maine is also the oldest state in our nation in the sense it's got the oldest median age, I think it's 45 or 46, older even than Florida. And so now it's really increasingly dependent upon young people who are leaving. So increasingly, I think people are starting to understand in Maine, we need the Somali kids to stay here and to help build the state's economy and to find good jobs and to help support everyone. And so it makes sense to be more accepting and to be more constructive and to institute policies and programs that benefit not just the Somali community, but, the whole community. And so that is, Maine is quite an interesting story of, a Somali community facing challenges, but also thriving oftentimes in the face of pretty overt xenophobia, which we're hearing now from the governor in that state, and also the particular mayor of Lewiston in particular, who has been pretty outspoken on certain issues.
The book, and its subtitle is Immigrants, Refugees, and America at Its Best. So when we are at its best, and you write about so many of those stories in this book, it helps as an antidote to the ugliness that we so often hear on this issue. Two examples, which you just gave in Lewiston. So I want to end on this note, and that is, do you have optimism that these stories can prevail in the end and that this will be ultimately the way of the land?
I think we have to. I don't think we really have a choice. I mean, the idea that we're going to, be a white country and, not accept people from other places and deport 11 million people, the vast majority of whom have U.S. citizen children here, is absurd. And doing nothing also doesn't work. So I think that these stories in this book can offer a kind of roadmap to getting to higher ground beyond xenophobia and beyond a kind of laissez-faire approach to immigration where we don't make any effort to extend a hand and to create integrative policies and programs.
The name of the book is Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at Its Best. Susan Eaton is the professor of the practice and director of the Silerman Center for the Advancement of Philanthropy at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management. The book is published by The New Press. Susan Eaton, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book is Integration Nation by Susan Eaton. It is published by The New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.